for he understood, or thought he understood, the modesty and delicacy of his bride. He was willing to wait until her fears subsided, only. He sighed as he twisted about seeking a comfortable position, for he was going away to the war so very soon. Nightmarish as her own wedding had been, Ashley's wedding was even worse. Scarlett stood in her apple-green second-day dress in the parlor of 12 Oaks, amid the blaze of hundreds of candles, jostled by the same throng as the night before, and saw the plain little face of Melanie Hamilton glow into beauty as she became Melanie Wilkes. Now Ashley was gone forever. Her Ashley. No, not her Ashley now. Had he ever been hers? It was all so mixed up in her mind, and her mind was so tired, so bewildered. He had said he loved her, but what was it that had separated them? If she could only remember. She had stilled the county's gossiping tongue by marrying Charles, but what did that matter now? It had seemed so important once, but now it didn't seem important at all. All that mattered was Ashley. Now he was gone, and she was married to a man she not only did not love, but for whom she had an active contempt. Oh, how she regretted it all. She had often heard of people cutting off their noses to spite their faces, but heretofore it had been only a figure of speech. Now she knew just what it meant. And mingled with her frenzied desire to be free of Charles, and safely back at Terra, an unmarried girl again, ran the knowledge that she had only herself to blame. Ellen had tried to stop her, and she would not listen. So she danced through the night of Ashley's wedding in a daze, and said things mechanically, and smiled, and irrelevantly wondered at the stupidity of people who thought her a happy bride, and who could not see that her heart was broken. Well, thank God they couldn't see. That night, after Mammy had helped her undress, and had departed, and Charles had emerged shyly from the dressing-room, wondering if he was to spend a second night in the horsehair chair, she burst into tears. She cried until Charles climbed into bed beside her and tried to comfort her. Cried without words, until no more tears would come, and at last she lay sobbing quietly on his shoulder. If there had not been a war, there would have been a week of visiting about the county, with balls and barbecues in honor of the two newly married couples, before they set off to Saratoga or White Sulphur for wedding trips. If there had not been a war, Scarlett would have had third day and fourth day and fifth day dresses to wear to the Fontaine and Calvert and Tarleton parties in her honor. But there were no parties now, and no wedding trips. A week after the wedding, Charles left to join Colonel Wade Hampton, and 2 weeks later, Ashley and the troop departed, leaving the whole county bereft. In those 2 weeks, Scarlett never saw Ashley alone, never had a private word with him, not even at the terrible moment of parting, when he stopped by Tara on his way to the train, did she have a private talk. Melanie, bonneted and shawled, sedate in newly acquired matronly dignity, hung on his arm, and the entire personnel of Tara, black and white, turned out to see Ashley off to the war. Melanie said, "You must kiss Scarlett, Ashley. She's my sister now." And Ashley bent and touched her cheek with cold lips, his face drawn and taut. Scarlett could hardly take any joy from that kiss, so sullen was her heart at Melly's prompting it. Melanie smothered her with an embrace at parting. "You will come to Atlanta and visit me and Aunt Pittypat, won't you? Oh, darling, we want to have you so much. We want to know Charlie's wife better." 5 weeks passed during which letters, shy, ecstatic, loving, came from Charles in South Carolina telling of his love, his plans for the future when the war was over, his desire to become a hero for her sake, and his worship of his commander, Wade Hampton. In the 7th week, there came a telegram from Colonel Hampton himself, and then a letter, a kind, dignified letter of condolence. Charles was dead. The colonel would have wired earlier, but Charles, thinking his illness a trifling one, did not wish to have his family worried. The unfortunate boy had not only been cheated of the love he thought he had won, but also of his high hopes of honor and glory on the field of battle. He had died ignominiously and swiftly of pneumonia following measles, without ever having gotten any closer to the Yankees than the camp in South Carolina. In due time, Charles' son was born, and because it was fashionable to name boys after their father's commanding officers, he was called Wade Hampton Hamilton. Scarlett had wept with despair at the knowledge that she was pregnant, and wished that she were dead. But she carried the child through its time with a minimum of discomfort, bore him with little distress, and recovered so quickly that Mammy told her privately it was downright common. Ladies should suffer more. She felt little affection for the child, hide the fact though she might. She had not wanted him, and she resented his coming, and now that he was here, it did not seem possible that he was hers, a part of her. Though she recovered physically from Wade's birth in a disgracefully short time, mentally she was dazed and sick. Her spirits drooped, despite the efforts of the whole plantation to revive them. Ellen went about with a puckered, worried forehead, and Gerald swore more frequently than usual, and brought her useless gifts from Jonesboro. Even old Dr. Fontaine admitted that he was puzzled, after his tonic of sulfur, molasses, and herbs failed to perk her up. He told Ellen privately that it was a broken heart that made Scarlett so irritable and listless by turns. But Scarlett, had she wished to speak, could have told them that it was a far different and more complex trouble. She did not tell them that it was utter boredom, bewilderment at actually being a mother, and most of all, the absence of Ashley that made her look so woebegone. Her boredom was acute and ever-present. The county had been devoid of any entertainment or social life ever since the troop had gone away to war. All of the interesting young men were gone. The four Charltons, the two Calverts, the Fontaines, the Monroes, and everyone from Jonesboro, Fayetteville, and Lovejoy, who was young and attractive. Only the older men, the cripples, and the women were left, and they spent their time knitting and sewing, growing more cotton and corn, raising more hogs and sheep and cows for the army. There was never a sight of a real man except when the commissary troop, under Sue Ellen's middle-aged beau, Frank Kennedy, rode by every month to collect supplies. The men in the commissary were not very exciting, and the sight of Frank's timid courting annoyed her until she found it difficult to be polite to him. If he and Sue Ellen would only get it over with! Even if the commissary troop had been more interesting, it would not have helped her situation any. She was a widow, and her heart was in the grave. At least, everyone thought it was in the grave and expected her to act accordingly. This irritated her, for, try as she could recall nothing about Charles except the dying calf look on his face when she told him she would marry him. And even that picture was fading. But she was a widow, and she had to watch her behavior. Not for her the pleasures of unmarried girls. She had to be grave and aloof. Ellen had stressed this at great length, after catching Frank's lieutenant swinging Scarlett in the garden swing and making her squeal with laughter. Deeply distressed, Ellen had told her how easily a widow might get herself talked about. The conduct of a widow must be twice as circumspect as that of a matron. "And God only knows," thought Scarlett, listening obediently to her mother's soft voice. "Matrons never have any fun at all, so widows might as well be dead." A widow had to wear hideous black dresses without even a touch of braid to enliven them. No flower or ribbon or lace or even jewelry, except onyx mourning brooches or necklaces made from the deceased's hair. And the black crepe veil on her bonnet had to reach to her knees. And only after 3 years of widowhood could it be shortened to shoulder length. Widows could never chatter vivaciously or laugh aloud. Even when they smiled, it must be a sad, tragic smile. And most dreadful of all, they could in no way indicate an interest in the company of gentlemen. And should a gentleman be so ill-bred as to indicate an interest in her, she must freeze him with a dignified but well-chosen reference to her dead husband. Oh, yes, thought Scarlet, drearily, some widows do remarry eventually, when they are old and stringy. Though heaven knows how they manage it, with their neighbors watching. And then it's generally to some desperate old widower with a large plantation and a dozen children. Marriage was bad enough, but to be widowed, oh, then life was over forever. How stupid people were when they talked about what a comfort little Wade Hampton must be to her, now that Charles was gone. How stupid of them to say that now she had something to live for. Everyone talked about how sweet it was that she had this posthumous token of her love, and she naturally did not disabuse their minds. But that thought was farthest from her mind. She had very little interest in Wade, and sometimes it was difficult to remember that he was actually hers. Every morning she woke up, and for a drowsy moment she was Scarlet O'Hara again, and the sun was bright in the magnolia outside her window, and the mockers were singing, and the sweet smell of frying bacon was stealing to her nostrils. She was carefree and young again. Then she heard the fretful, hungry wail, and always, always there was a startled moment when she thought, "Why, there's a baby in the house." Then she remembered that it was her baby. It was all very bewildering. And Ashley. Oh, most of all, Ashley. For the first time in her life, she hated Tara, hated the long red road that led down the hill to the river, hated the red fields with springing green cotton. Every foot of ground, every tree and brook, every lane and bridle path reminded her of him. He belonged to another woman, and he had gone to the war. But his ghost still haunted the roads in the twilight, still smiled at her from drowsy gray eyes in the shadows of the porch. She never heard the sound of hooves coming up the river road from 12 Oaks, that for a sweet moment she did not think, "Ashley!" She hated 12 Oaks now, and once she had loved it. She hated it, but she was drawn there, so she could hear John Wilkes and the girls talk about him, hear them read his letters from Virginia. They hurt her, but she had to hear them. She disliked the stiff-necked India and the foolish prattling Honey, and knew they disliked her equally, but she could not stay away from them. And every time she came home from 12 Oaks, she lay down on her bed morosely and refused to get up for supper. It was this refusal of food that worried Ellen and Mammy more than anything else. Mammy brought up tempting trays, insinuating that now that she was a widow she might eat as much as she pleased. But Scarlet had no appetite. When Dr. Fontaine told Ellen gravely that heartbreak frequently led to a decline, and women pined away into the grave, Ellen went white, for that fear was what she had carried in her heart. "Isn't there anything to be done, Doctor?"
"A change of scene will be the best thing in the world for her," said the doctor, only too anxious to be rid of an unsatisfactory patient.
So Scarlet, unenthusiastic, went off with her child first to visit her O'Hara and Robillard relatives in Savannah, and then to Ellen's sisters, Pauline and Eulalie, in Charleston. But she was back at Tara a month before Ellen expected her, with no explanation of her return. They had been kind in Savannah, but James and Andrew and their wives were old and content to sit quietly and talk of a past in which Scarlet had no interest. It was the same with the Robillards, and Charleston was terrible, Scarlet thought. Aunt Pauline and her husband, a little old man with a formal brittle courtesy, and the absent heir of one living in an older age, lived on a plantation on the river, far more isolated than Tara. Their nearest neighbor was 20 miles away by dark roads, through still jungles of cypress swamp and oak. The live oaks, with their waving curtains of gray moss, gave Scarlet the creeps, and always brought to her mind Gerald's stories of Irish ghosts roaming in shimmering grey mists. There was nothing to do but knit all day, and at night listen to Uncle Carrie read aloud from the improving works of Mr. Bulwer Lytton. Eulalie, hidden behind a high-walled garden in a great house on the Battery in Charleston, was no more entertaining. Scarlet, accustomed to wide vistas of rolling red hills, felt that she was in prison. There was more social life here than at Aunt Pauline's, but Scarlet did not like the people who called, with their airs and their traditions and their emphasis on family. She knew very well they all thought she was a child of a mésalliance, and wondered how a Robillard ever married a newly-come Irishman. Scarlet felt that Aunt Eulalie apologized for her behind her back. This aroused her temper, for she cared no more about family than her father. She was proud of Gerald and what he had accomplished unaided, except by his shrewd Irish brain. And the Charlestonians took so much upon themselves about Fort Sumter. Good heavens! Didn't they realize that if they hadn't been silly enough to fire the shot that started the war, some other fools would have done it? Accustomed to the brisk voices of upland Georgia, the drawling, flat voices of the Low Country seemed affected to her. She thought if she ever again heard voices that said "palms" for palms, and "hoose" for house, and "woont" for won't, and "ma" and "pa" for ma and pa, she would scream. It irritated her so much that during one formal call she ate Gerald's brogue to her aunt's distress. Then she went back to Tara. Better to be tormented with memories of Ashley than Charleston accents. Ellen, busy night and day, doubling the productiveness of Tara to aid the Confederacy, was terrified when her eldest daughter came home from Charleston, thin, white, and sharp-tongued. She had known heartbreak herself, and night after night she lay beside the snoring Gerald, trying to think of some way to lessen Scarlet's distress. Charles's aunt, Miss Pittypat Hamilton, had written her several times, urging her to permit Scarlet to come to Atlanta for a long visit. And now, for the first time, Ellen considered it seriously. She and Melanie were alone in a big house, and without male protection, wrote Miss Pittypat, now that dear Charlie has gone. Of course, there is my brother Henry, but he does not make his home with us. But perhaps Scarlet has told you of Henry. Delicacy forbids my putting more concerning him on paper. Melly and I would feel so much easier and safer if Scarlet were with us. Three lonely women are better than two, and perhaps dear Scarlet could find some ease for her sorrow, as Melanie is doing, by nursing our brave boys in the hospitals here. And, of course, Melly and I are longing to see the dear baby. So Scarlet's trunk was packed again, with her morning clothes. And off she went to Atlanta with Wade Hampton and his nurse, Prissy, a head full of admonitions as to her conduct from Ellen and Mammy, and $100 in Confederate bills from Gerald. She did not especially want to go to Atlanta. She thought Aunt Pittypat the silliest of old ladies, and the very idea of living under the same roof with Ashley's wife was abhorrent. But the county, with its memories, was impossible now. And any change was welcome. Part 2. Chapter 8. As the train carried Scarlet northward that May morning in 1862, she thought that Atlanta couldn't possibly be so boring as Charleston and Savannah had been. And in spite of her distaste for Miss Pittypat and Melanie, she looked forward with some curiosity toward seeing how the town had fared since her last visit, in the winter before the war began. Atlanta had always interested her more than any other town, because when she was a child, Gerald had told her that she and Atlanta were exactly the same age. She discovered, when she grew older, that Gerald had stretched the truth somewhat, as was his habit when a little stretching would improve a story. But Atlanta was only 9 years older than she was, and that still left the place amazingly young by comparison with any other town she had ever heard of. Savannah and Charleston had the dignity of their years, one being well along in its second century and the other entering its third. And in her young eyes, they had always seemed like aged grandmothers fanning themselves placidly in the sun. But Atlanta was of her own generation, crude with the crudities of youth, and as headstrong and impetuous as herself. The story Gerald had told her was based on the fact that she and Atlanta were christened in the same year. In the 9 years before Scarlett was born, the town had been called first Terminus, and then Marthasville, and not until the year of Scarlett's birth had it become Atlanta. When Gerald first moved to North Georgia, there had been no Atlanta at all, not even the semblance of a village, and wilderness rolled over the site. But the next year, in 1836, the state had authorized the building of a railroad northwestward through the territory which the Cherokees had recently ceded. The destination of the proposed railroad, Tennessee and the West, was clear and definite. But its beginning point in Georgia was somewhat uncertain until, a year later, an engineer drove a stake in the red clay to mark the southern end of the line, and Atlanta, born Terminus, had begun. There were no railroads then in North Georgia, and very few anywhere else. But during the years before Gerald married Ellen, the tiny settlement 25 miles north of Tara slowly grew into a village, and the tracks slowly pushed northward. Then the railroad building era really began. From the old city of Augusta, a second railroad was extended westward across the state to connect with a new road to Tennessee. From the old city of Savannah, a third railroad was built first to Macon, in the heart of Georgia, and then north through Gerald's own county to Atlanta, to link up with the other two roads and give Savannah's harbor a highway to the west. From the same junction point, the young Atlanta, a fourth railroad was constructed southwestward to Montgomery and Mobile. Born of a railroad, Atlanta grew as its railroads grew. With the completion of the four lines, Atlanta was now connected with the west, with the south, with the coast, and through Augusta, with the north and east. It had become the crossroads of travel north and south and east and west. And the little village leaped to life. In a space of time but little longer than Scarlett's 17 years, Atlanta had grown from a single stake driven in the ground into a thriving small city of 10,000 that was the center of attention for the whole state. The older, quieter cities were wont to look upon the bustling new town with the sensations of a hen which has hatched a duckling. Why was the place so different from the other Georgia towns? Why did it grow so fast? After all, they thought, it had nothing whatever to recommend it, only its railroads and a bunch of mighty pushy people. The people who settled the town, called successively Terminus, Marthasville, and Atlanta, were a pushy people. Restless, energetic people from the older sections of Georgia and from more distant states were drawn to this town that sprawled itself around the junction of the railroads in its center. They came with enthusiasm. They built their stores around the five muddy red roads that crossed near the depot. They built their fine homes on Whitehall and Washington streets, and along the high ridge of land on which countless generations of moccasined Indian feet had beaten a path called the Peachtree Trail. They were proud of the place, proud of its growth, proud of themselves for making it grow. Let the older towns call Atlanta anything they pleased. Atlanta did not care. Scarlett had always liked Atlanta for the very same reasons that made Savannah, Augusta, and Macon condemn it. Like herself, the town was a mixture of the old and new in Georgia, in which the old often came off second best in its conflicts with the self-willed and vigorous new. Moreover, there was something personal exciting about a town that was born, or at least christened, the same year she was christened. The night before had been wild and wet with rain. But when Scarlet arrived in Atlanta, a warm sun was at work, bravely attempting to dry the streets that were winding rivers of red mud. In the open space around the depot, the soft ground had been cut and churned by the constant flow of traffic in and out, until it resembled an enormous hog wallow, and here and there vehicles were mired to the hubs in the ruts. A never-ceasing line of army wagons and ambulances, loading and unloading supplies and wounded from the trains, made the mud and confusion worse as they toiled in and struggled out, drivers swearing, mules plunging and mud spattering for yards. Scarlet stood on the lower step of the train, a pale, pretty figure in her black mourning dress, her crepe veil fluttering almost to her heels. She hesitated, unwilling to soil her slippers and hems, and looked about in the shouting tangle of wagons, buggies, and carriages for Miss Pittypat. There was no sign of that chubby, pink-cheeked lady, but as Scarlet searched anxiously, a spare old Negro with grizzled kinks and an air of dignified authority came toward her through the mud, his hat in his hand.
"'Dis Miss Scarlet, ain't it? "'Dis yere, Peter, Miss Pitty's coachman.' "'Don't step down in dat mud,' he ordered severely.
As Scarlet gathered up her skirts, preparatory to descending.
"'You is as bad as Miss Pitty, and she like a child about getting her feet sweat. "'Lemme care you.'
He picked Scarlet up with ease, despite his apparent frailness and age, and, observing Prissy standing on the platform of the train, the baby in her arms, he paused.
"'Is that a child your nurse?' "'Miss Scarlet, she too young to be handling Mr. Charles' onlyest baby. "'But we tend to that later. "'You, gal, follow me, and don't you go dropping that baby.'
"'Scarlet submitted meekly to being carried toward the carriage, "'and also to the peremptory manner in which Uncle Peter criticized her and Prissy. As they went through the mud with Prissy sloshing, pouting after them, she recalled what Charles had said about Uncle Peter.
"'He went through all the Mexican campaigns with Father, nursed him when he was wounded. In fact, he saved his life. Uncle Peter practically raised Melly and me, for we were very young when Father and Mother died. Aunt Pitty had a falling out with her brother, Uncle Henry, about that time, so she came to live with us and take care of us. She is the most helpless soul, just like a sweet grown-up child. And Uncle Peter treats her that way. To save her life, she couldn't make up her mind about anything, so Peter makes it up for her. He was the one who decided I should have a larger allowance when I was 15, and he insisted that I should go to Harvard for my senior year, when Uncle Henry wanted me to take my degree at the university. And he decided when Melly was old enough to put up her hair and go to parties. He tells Aunt Pitty when it's too cold or too wet for her to go calling, and when she should wear a shawl. He's the smartest old donkey I've ever seen, and about the most devoted. The only trouble with him is that he owns the three of us, body and soul, and he knows it.
Charles' words were confirmed as Peter climbed onto the box and took the whip.
"'Miss Pitty in a state because she didn't come to meet you. "'She's feared you might not understand, but I told her she and Miss Melly just get splashed with mud and ruined their new dresses, and I explained to you. "'Miss Scarlet, you better take that child, that little pickaninny, gwine let it drop.'
Scarlet looked at Prissy and sighed. Prissy was not the most adequate of nurses. Her recent graduation from a skinny pickaninny with brief skirts and stiffly wrapped braids into the dignity of a long calico dress and starched white turban was an intoxicating affair. She would never have arrived at this eminence so early in life had not the exigencies of war and the demands of the commissary department on Terra made it impossible for Ellen to spare Mammy or Dilsey or even Rosa or Tina. Prissy had never been more than a mile away from Twelve Oaks or Terra before, and the trip on the train, plus her elevation to nurse, was almost more than the brain in her little black skull could bear. The 20-mile journey from Jonesboro to Atlanta had so excited her that Scarlett had been forced to hold the baby all the way. Now the sight of so many buildings and people completed Prissy's demoralization. She twisted from side to side, pointed, bounced about, and so jaunced the baby that he wailed miserably. Scarlett longed for the fat old arms of Mammy. Mammy had only to lay hands on a child, and it hushed crying. But Mammy was at Terra, and there was nothing Scarlett could do. It was useless for her to take little Wade from Prissy. He yelled just as loudly when she held him as when Prissy did. Besides, he would tug at the ribbons of her bonnet and, no doubt, rumple her dress. So she pretended she had not heard Uncle Peter's suggestion. "Maybe I'll learn about babies sometime," she thought irritably, as the carriage jolted and swayed out of the morass surrounding the station. "But I'm never going to like fooling with them." And as Wade's face went purple with his squalling, she snapped crossly, "Give him that sugar tit in your pocket, Pris. Anything to make him hush. I know he's hungry, but I can't do anything about that now." Prissy produced the sugar tit, given her that morning by Mammy, and the baby's wails subsided. With quiet restored, and with the new sights that met her eyes, Scarlett's spirits began to rise a little. When Uncle Peter finally maneuvered the carriage out of the mud holes and onto Peachtree Street, she felt the first surge of interest she had known in months. How the town had grown! It was not much more than a year since she had last been here, and it did not seem possible that the little Atlanta she knew could have changed so much. For the past year she had been so engrossed in her own woes, so bored by any mention of war. She didn't know that from the minute the fighting first began, Atlanta had been transformed. The same railroads which had made the town the crossroads of commerce in time of peace were now of vital strategic importance in time of war. Far from the battle lines, the town and its railroads provided the connecting link between the two armies of the Confederacy, the Army in Virginia and the Army in Tennessee and the West. And Atlanta likewise linked both of the armies with the deeper South from which they drew their supplies. Now, in response to the needs of war, Atlanta had become a manufacturing center, a hospital base, and one of the South's chief depots for the collecting of food and supplies for the armies in the field. Scarlett looked about her for the little town she remembered so well. It was gone. The town she was now seeing was like a baby grown overnight into a busy, sprawling giant. Atlanta was humming like a beehive, proudly conscious of its importance to the Confederacy. And work was going forward night and day toward turning an agricultural section into an industrial one. Before the war, there had been few cotton factories, woolen mills, arsenals, and machine shops south of Maryland, a fact of which all Southerners were proud. The South produced statesmen and soldiers, planters and doctors, lawyers and poets, but certainly not engineers or mechanics. Let the Yankees adopt such low callings. But now the Confederate ports were stoppered with Yankee gunboats. Only a trickle of blockade-run goods was slipping in from Europe, and the South was desperately trying to manufacture her own war materials. The North could call on the whole world for supplies and for soldiers, and thousands of Irish and Germans were pouring into the Union Army, lured by the bounty money offered by the North. The South could only turn in upon itself. In Atlanta, there were machine factories tediously turning out machinery to manufacture war materials. Tediously, because there were few machines in the South from which they could model, and nearly every wheel and cog had to be made from drawings that came through the blockade from England. There were strange faces on the streets of Atlanta now, and citizens who a year ago would have pricked up their ears at the sound of even a Western accent paid no heed to the foreign tongues of Europeans, who had run the blockade to build machines and turn out Confederate munitions. Skilled men, these, without whom the Confederacy would have been hard put to make pistols, rifles, cannon, and powder. Almost the pulsing of the town's heart could be felt as the work went forward night and day, pumping the materials of war up the railway arteries to the two battlefronts. Trains roared in and out of town at all hours. Soot from the newly erected factories fell in showers on the white houses. By night, the furnaces glowed and the hammers clanged long after townsfolk were abed. Where vacant lots had been a year before, there were now factories turning out harness, saddles and shoes, ordnance supply plants making rifles and cannon, rolling mills and foundries producing iron rails and freight cars to replace those destroyed by the Yankees, and a variety of industries manufacturing spurs, bridle bits, buckles, tents, buttons, pistols, and swords. Already the foundries were beginning to feel the lack of iron, for little or none came through the blockade, and the mines in Alabama were standing almost idle while the miners were at the front. There were no iron picket fences, iron summer houses, iron gates, or even iron statuary on the lawns of Atlanta now, for they had early found their way into the melting pots of the rolling mills. Here along Peachtree Street and nearby streets were the headquarters of the various army departments, each office swarming with uniformed men, the commissary, the signal corps, the mail service, the railway transport, the provost marshal. On the outskirts of town were the remount depots where horses and mules milled about in large corrals, and along side streets were the hospitals. As Uncle Peter told her about them, Scarlett felt that Atlanta must be a city of the wounded. For there were general hospitals, contagious hospitals, convalescent hospitals without number. And every day the trains just below Five Points disgorged more sick and more wounded. The little town was gone, and the face of the rapidly growing city was animated with never-ceasing energy and bustle. The sight of so much hurrying made Scarlett, fresh from rural leisure and quiet, almost breathless. But she liked it. There was an exciting atmosphere about the place that uplifted her. It was as if she could actually feel the accelerated, steady pulse of the town's heart beating in time with her own. As they slowly made their way through the mud holes of the town's chief street, she noted with interest all the new buildings and the new faces. The sidewalks were crowded with men in uniform, bearing the insignia of all ranks and all service branches. The narrow street was jammed with vehicles, carriages, buggies, ambulances, covered army wagons with profane drivers swearing as the mules struggled through the ruts. Gray-clad couriers dashed spattering through the streets from one headquarters to another, bearing orders and telegraphic dispatches. Convalescents limped about on crutches, usually with a solicitous lady at either elbow. Bugle and drum and barked orders sounded from the drill fields where the recruits were being turned into soldiers. And with her heart in her throat, Scarlett had her first sight of Yankee uniforms, as Uncle Peter pointed with his whip to a detachment of dejected-looking bluecoats being shepherded toward the depot by a squad of Confederates with fixed bayonets to entrain for the prison camp. Oh, thought Scarlett, with the first feeling of real pleasure she had experienced since the day of the barbecue. I'm going to like it here. It's so alive and exciting. The town was even more alive than she realized, for there were new bar rooms by the dozens. Prostitutes following the army swarmed the town, and bawdy houses were blossoming with women to the consternation of the church people. Every hotel, boarding house, and private residence was crammed with visitors who had come to be near wounded relatives in the big Atlanta hospitals. There were parties and balls and bazaars every week, and war weddings without number. With the grooms on furlough in bright gray and gold braid, and the brides in blockade-run finery, aisles of crossed swords, toasts drunk in blockaded champagne, and tearful farewells. Nightly, the dark tree-lined streets resounded with dancing feet. And from parlors tinkled pianos where soprano voices blended with those of soldier guests in the pleasing melancholy of "The Bugles Sang Truce." And "Your Letter Came, But Came Too Late." Plaintive ballads that brought exciting tears to soft eyes, which had never known the tears of real grief. As they progressed down the street, through the sucking mud, Scarlet bubbled over with questions, and Peter answered them, pointing here and there with his whip, proud to display his knowledge.
"Dat air de arsenal."
"Yes'm.
Dey keeps guns and sech like dere."
"No'm, dem dere ain't stores. Dey's blockade officers."
"Law, Miss Scarlet, don't you know what blockade officers is?"
"Dey's officers where furriners stay dat buys us Confederates cotton and ship it out of Charleston and Wilmington and ship us back gunpowder."
"No'm, I ain't sure what kind of furriners dey is."
"Miss Pitty, she say dey's English, but can't nobody understand a word dey says."
"Yes'm, 'tis powerful smoky, and de suit just ruinin' Miss Pitty's silk curtains. It's from de foundry and de rolling mills. And de noise dey makes at night, can't nobody sleep."
"No'm, I can't stop for you to look around. I done promise Miss Pitty I'll bring you straight home. Miss Scarlet, make your curtsy. Dar's Miss Meriwether and Miss Elsing a-bowing to you."
Scarlet vaguely remembered two ladies of those names who came from Atlanta to Terra to attend her wedding, and she remembered that they were Miss Pittypat's best friends. So she turned quickly where Uncle Peter pointed and bowed. The two were sitting in a carriage outside a dry goods store. The proprietor and two clerks stood on the sidewalk with armfuls of bolts of cotton cloth that they had been displaying. Mrs. Meriwether was a tall, stout woman, and so tightly corseted that her bust jutted forward like the prow of a ship. Her iron-gray hair was eked out by a curled false fringe that was proudly brown and disdained to match the rest of her hair. She had a round, highly colored face, in which was combined good-natured shrewdness and the habit of command. Mrs. Elsing was younger, a thin, frail woman who had been a beauty, and about her there still clung a faded freshness, a dainty, imperious air. These two ladies, with a third, Mrs. Whiting, were the pillars of Atlanta. They ran the three churches to which they belonged, the clergy, the choirs, and the parishioners. They organized bazaars and presided over sewing circles. They chaperoned balls and picnics. They knew who made good matches and who did not, who drank secretly, who were to have babies and when. They were authorities on the genealogies of everyone who was anyone in Georgia, South Carolina, and Virginia, and did not bother their heads about the other states, because they believed that no one who was anybody ever came from states other than these three. They knew what was decorous behavior and what was not, and they never failed to make their opinions known. Mrs. Meriwether at the top of her voice. Mrs. Elsing in an elegant die-away drawl. And Mrs. Whiting in a distressed whisper, which showed how much she hated to speak of such things. These three ladies disliked and distrusted one another as heartily as the first triumvirate of Rome, and their close alliance was probably for the same reason.
"I told Pitty I had to have you in my hospital," called Mrs. Meriwether, smiling. "Don't you go promising Mrs. Meade or Mrs. Whiting."
I won't, said Scarlet, having no idea what Mrs. Merriweather was talking about, but feeling a glow of warmth at being welcomed and wanted.
I hope to see you again soon.
The carriage ploughed its way farther, and halted for a moment to permit two ladies with baskets of bandages on their arms to pick precarious passages across the sloppy street on stepping stones. At the same moment, Scarlet's eye was caught by a figure on the sidewalk in a brightly colored dress, too bright for streetwear, covered by a paisley shawl with fringes to the heels. Turning, she saw a tall, handsome woman with a bold face and a mass of red hair, too red to be true. It was the first time she had ever seen any woman who she knew for certain had done something to her hair, and she watched her, fascinated.
"Uncle Peter, who is that?" she whispered.
"I don't know."
"You do, too, I can tell. Who is she?"
"Her name's Belle Watling," said Uncle Peter, his lower lip beginning to protrude.
Scarlet was quick to catch the fact that he had not preceded the name with Miss or Mrs.
"Who is she?"
"Miss Scarlet,"
said Peter darkly, laying a whip on the startled horse.
"Miss Pity ain't gwine to like it. You asking questions that ain't none of your business. There's a parcel of no-count folks in this town now that it ain't no use talking about."
"Good heavens," thought Scarlet, reproved into silence. "That must be a bad woman."
She had never seen a bad woman before, and she twisted her head and stared after her until she was lost in the crowd. The stores in the new war buildings were farther apart now, with vacant lots between. Finally, the business section fell behind, and the residences came into view. Scarlet picked them out as old friends. The Leyden House, dignified and stately. The Bunnells, with little white columns and green blinds. The close-lipped red-brick Georgian home of the McClure family, behind its low box hedges. Their progress was slower now, for from porches and gardens and sidewalks ladies called to her. Some she knew slightly, others she vaguely remembered, but most of them she knew not at all. Pitypat had certainly broadcast her arrival. Little Wade had to be held up time and again so that ladies who ventured as far through the ooze as their carriage blocks could exclaim over him. They all cried to her that she must join their knitting and sewing circles, and their hospital committees, and no one else's, and she promised recklessly to right and left. As they passed a rambling green clapboard house, a little black girl posted on the front steps cried, "Here she come!" And Dr. Mead and his wife and little 13-year-old Phil emerged calling greetings. Scarlet recalled that they, too, had been at her wedding. Mrs. Mead mounted her carriage block and craned her neck for a view of the baby, but the doctor, disregarding the mud, ploughed through to the side of the carriage. He was tall and gaunt and wore a pointed beard of iron gray, and his clothes hung on his spare figure as though blown there by a hurricane. Atlanta considered him the root of all strength and all wisdom, and it was not strange that he had absorbed something of their belief. But for all his habit of making oracular statements and his slightly pompous manner, he was as kindly a man as the town possessed. After shaking her hand and prodding Wade in the stomach and complimenting him, the doctor announced that Aunt Pitypat had promised on oath that Scarlet should be on no other hospital and bandage-rolling committee save Mrs. Mead's.
"Oh, dear, but I've promised 1,000 ladies already," said Scarlet.
"Mrs. Merriweather, I'll be bound," cried Mrs. Mead indignantly. "Drat the woman. I believe she meets every train."
"I promised because I hadn't a notion what it was all about," Scarlet confessed. "What are hospital committees, anyway?"
Both the doctor and his wife looked slightly shocked at her ignorance. "But, of course, you've been buried in the country and couldn't know." Mrs. Mead apologized for her. "We have nursing committees for different hospitals and for different days. We nurse the men and help the doctors and make bandages and clothes. And when the men are well enough to leave the hospitals, we take them into our homes to convalesce till they are able to go back in the army. And we look after the wives and families of some of the wounded who are destitute. Yes, worse than destitute. Dr. Mead is at the Institute Hospital where my committee works, and everyone says he's marvelous and—"
"There, there, Mrs. Mead," said the doctor fondly. "Don't go bragging on me in front of folks. It's little enough I can do since you wouldn't let me go in the army."
"Wouldn't let?" she cried indignantly. "Me? The town wouldn't let you, and you know it. Why, Scarlet, when folks heard he was intending to go to Virginia as an army surgeon, all the ladies signed a petition begging him to stay here. Of course, the town couldn't do without you."
"There, there, Mrs. Mead," said the doctor, basking obviously in the praise. "Perhaps with one boy at the front, that's enough for the time being."
"And I'm going next year," cried little Phil, hopping about excitedly, "as a drummer boy. I'm learning how to drum now. Do you want to hear me? I'll run get my drum."
"No, not now," said Mrs. Mead, drawing him closer to her, a sudden look of strain coming over her face. "Not next year, darling. Maybe the year after."
"But the war will be over then," he cried petulantly, pulling away from her. "And you promised."
Over his head, the eyes of the parents met, and Scarlett saw the look. Darcy Mead was in Virginia, and they were clinging closer to the little boy that was left. Uncle Peter cleared his throat.
"Miss Pitty were in a state when I left home, and if I don't get there soon, she'll done swooned."
"Goodbye. I'll be over this afternoon," called Mrs. Mead. "And you tell Pitty for me that if you aren't on my committee, she's going to be in a worse state."
The carriage slipped and slid down the muddy road, and Scarlett leaned back on the cushions and smiled. She felt better now than she had felt in months. Atlanta, with its crowds and its hurry and its undercurrent of driving excitement, was very pleasant, very exhilarating, so very much nicer than the lonely plantation out from Charleston, where the bellow of alligators broke the night stillness. Better than Charleston itself, dreaming in its gardens behind its high walls. Better than Savannah, with its wide streets lined with palmetto and the muddy river beside it. Yes. And temporarily, even better than Tara, dear though Tara was. There was something exciting about this town with its narrow, muddy streets, lying among rolling red hills, something raw and crude that appealed to the rawness and crudeness underlying the fine veneer that Ellen and Mammy had given her. She suddenly felt that this was where she belonged, not in serene and quiet old cities, flat beside yellow waters. The houses were farther and farther apart now, and leaning out, Scarlett saw the red brick and slate roof of Miss Pittypat's house. It was almost the last house on the north side of town. Beyond it, Peachtree Road narrowed and twisted under great trees, out of sight into thick, quiet woods. The neat wooden-paneled fence had been newly painted white, and the front yard it enclosed was yellow, starred with the last jonquils of the season. On the front step stood two women in black, and behind them a large yellow woman with her hands under her apron and her white teeth showing in a wide smile. Plump Miss Pittypat was teetering excitedly on tiny feet, one hand pressed to her copious bosom to still her fluttering heart. Scarlett saw Melanie standing by her side, and, with a surge of dislike,
she realized that the fly in the ointment of Atlanta would be this slight little person in black mourning dress, her riotous dark curls subdued to matronly smoothness, and a loving smile of welcome and happiness on her heart-shaped face. When a southerner took the trouble to pack a trunk and travel 20 miles for a visit, the visit was seldom of shorter duration than a month, usually much longer. Southerners were as enthusiastic visitors as they were hosts, and there was nothing unusual in relatives coming to spend the Christmas holidays and remaining until July. Often, when newly married couples went on the usual round of honeymoon visits, they lingered in some pleasant home until the birth of their second child. Frequently, elderly aunts and uncles came to Sunday dinner and remained until they were buried years later. Visitors presented no problem, for houses were large, servants numerous, and the feeding of several extra mouths a minor matter in that land of plenty. All ages and sexes went visiting, honeymooners, young mothers showing off new babies, convalescents, the bereaved, girls whose parents were anxious to remove them from the dangers of unwise matches, girls who had reached the danger age without becoming engaged, and who, it was hoped, would make suitable matches under the guidance of relatives in other places. Visitors added excitement and variety to the slow-moving southern life, and they were always welcome. So Scarlett had come to Atlanta with no idea as to how long she would remain. If her visit proved as dull as those in Savannah and Charleston, she would return home in a month. If her stay was pleasant, she would remain indefinitely. But no sooner had she arrived than Aunt Pittypat and Melanie began a campaign to induce her to make her home permanently with them. They brought up every possible argument. They wanted her for her own self because they loved her. They were lonely and often frightened at night in the big house. And she was so brave she gave them courage. She was so charming that she cheered them in their sorrow. Now that Charles was dead, her place and her son's place were with his kindred. Besides, half the house now belonged to her through Charles's will. Last, the Confederacy needed every pair of hands for sewing, knitting, bandage rolling, and nursing the wounded. Charles's Uncle Henry Hamilton, who lived in bachelor state at the Atlanta Hotel near the depot, also talked seriously to her on this subject. Uncle Henry was a short, pot-bellied, irascible old gentleman with a pink face, a shock of long silver hair, and an utter lack of patience with feminine timidities and vaporings. It was for the latter reason that he was barely on speaking terms with his sister, Miss Pittypat. From childhood, they had been exact opposites in temperament, and they had been further estranged by his objections to the manner in which she had reared Charles. "Making a damn sissy out of a soldier's son." Years before, he had so insulted her that now Miss Pitty never spoke of him except in guarded whispers, and with so great reticence that a stranger would have thought the honest old lawyer a murderer, at the least. The insult had occurred on a day when Pitty wished to draw $500 from her estate, of which he was trustee, to invest in a non-existent gold mine. He had refused to permit it, and stated heatedly that she had no more sense than a June bug, and furthermore it gave him the fidgets to be around her longer than 5 minutes. Since that day, she only saw him formally, once a month, when Uncle Peter drove her to his office to get the housekeeping money. After these brief visits, Pitty always took to her bed for the rest of the day with tears and smelling salts. Melanie and Charles, who were on excellent terms with their uncle, had frequently offered to relieve her of this ordeal, but Pitty always set her babyish mouth firmly and refused. Henry was her cross, and she must bear him. From this, Charles and Melanie could only infer that she took a profound pleasure in this occasional excitement, the only excitement in her sheltered life. Uncle Henry liked Scarlett immediately. Because, he said, he could see that for all her silly affectations, she had a few grains of sense. He was trustee, not only of Pitty's and Melanie's estates, but also of that left Scarlett by Charles. It came to Scarlett as a pleasant surprise that she was now a well-to-do young woman. For Charles had not only left her half of Aunt Pitty's house, but farmlands and town property as well. And the stores and warehouses along the railroad track near the depot, which were part of her inheritance, had tripled in value since the war began. It was when Uncle Henry was giving her an account of her property that he broached the matter of her permanent residence in Atlanta.
"When Wade Hampton comes of age, he's going to be a rich young man," he said. "The way Atlanta is growing, his property will be 10 times more valuable in 20 years, and it's only right that a boy should be raised where his property is, so he can learn to take care of it. Yes, and of Pitty's and Melanie's, too. He'll be the only man of the Hamilton name left before long, for I won't be here forever."
As for Uncle Peter, he took it for granted that Scarlett had come to stay. It was inconceivable to him that Charles's only son should be reared where he could not supervise the rearing. To all these arguments, Scarlett smiled, but said nothing, unwilling to commit herself before learning how she would like Atlanta and constant association with her in-laws. She knew, too, that Gerald and Ellen would have to be won over. Moreover, now that she was away from Tara, she missed it dreadfully. Missed the red fields and the springing green cotton and the sweet twilight silences. For the first time, she realized dimly what Gerald had meant when he said that the love of the land was in her blood. So she gracefully evaded, for the time being, a definite answer as to the duration of her visit, and slipped easily into the life of the red brick house at the quiet end of Peachtree Street. Living with Charles's blood kin, seeing the home from which he came, Scarlett could now understand a little better the boy who had made her wife, widow, and mother in such rapid succession. It was easy to see why he had been so shy, so unsophisticated, so idealistic. If Charles had inherited any of the qualities of the stern, fearless, hot-tempered soldier who had been his father, they had been obliterated in childhood by the ladylike atmosphere in which he had been reared. He had been devoted to the childlike Pitty, and closer than brothers usually are to Melanie. And two more sweet, unworldly women could not be found. Aunt Pittypat had been christened Sarah Jane Hamilton 60 years before. But since the long past day when her doting father had fastened this nickname upon her, because of her airy, restless, pattering little feet, no one had called her anything else. In the years that followed that second christening, many changes had taken place in her that made the pet name incongruous. Of the swiftly scampering child, all that now remained were 2 tiny feet, inadequate to her weight, and a tendency to prattle happily and aimlessly. She was stout, pink-cheeked and silver-haired, and always a little breathless from too tightly laced stays. She was unable to walk more than a block on the tiny feet, which she crammed into 2 small slippers. She had a heart which fluttered at any excitement, and she pampered it shamelessly, fainting at any provocation. Everyone knew that her swoons were generally mere ladylike pretenses, but they loved her enough to refrain from saying so. Everyone loved her, spoiled her like a child, and refused to take her seriously. Everyone except her brother Henry. She liked gossip better than anything else in the world, even more than she liked the pleasures of the table, and she prattled on for hours about other people's affairs in a harmless, kindly way. She had no memory for names, dates, or places, and frequently confused the actors in one Atlanta drama with the actors in another, which misled no one, for no one was foolish enough to take seriously anything she said. No one ever told her anything really shocking or scandalous, for her spinster state must be protected, even if she was 60 years old. And her friends were in a kindly conspiracy to keep her a sheltered and petted old child. Melanie was like her aunt in many ways. She had her shyness, her sudden blushes, her modesty. But she did have common sense. Of a sort, I'll admit that, Scarlett thought grudgingly. Like Aunt Pity, Melanie had the face of a sheltered child who had never known anything but simplicity and kindness, truth and love. A child who had never looked upon harshness or evil and would not recognize them if she saw them. Because she had always been happy, she wanted everyone about her to be happy or at least pleased with themselves. To this end, she always saw the best in everyone and remarked kindly upon it. There was no servant so stupid that she did not find some redeeming trait of loyalty and kind-heartedness. No girl so ugly and disagreeable that she could not discover grace of form or nobility of character in her. And no man so worthless or so boring that she did not view him in the light of his possibilities rather than his actualities. Because of these qualities that came sincerely and spontaneously from a generous heart, everyone flocked about her. For who can resist the charm of one who discovers in others admirable qualities undreamed of even by himself? She had more girlfriends than anyone in town, and more men friends, too. Though she had few beaus, for she lacked the willfulness and selfishness that go far toward trapping men's hearts. What Melanie did was no more than all Southern girls were taught to do. To make those about them feel at ease and pleased with themselves. It was this happy feminine conspiracy which made Southern society so pleasant. Women knew that a land where men were contented, uncontradicted, and safe in possession of unpunctured vanity, was likely to be a very pleasant place for women to live. So, from the cradle to the grave, women strove to make men pleased with themselves, and the satisfied men repaid lavishly with gallantry and adoration. In fact, men willingly gave the ladies everything in the world except credit for having intelligence. Scarlett exercised the same charms as Melanie, but with a studied artistry and consummate skill. The difference between the two girls lay in the fact that Melanie spoke kind and flattering words from a desire to make people happy, if only temporarily. And Scarlett never did it except to further her own aims. From the two he loved best, Charles had received no toughening influences, learned nothing of harshness or reality, and the home in which he grew to manhood was as soft as a bird's nest. It was such a quiet, old-fashioned, gentle home compared with Tara. To Scarlett, this house cried out for the masculine smells of brandy, tobacco, and macassar oil, for hoarse voices and occasional curses, for guns, for whiskers, for saddles and bridles, and for hounds underfoot. She missed the sounds of quarreling voices that were always heard at Tara when Ellen's back was turned. Mammy quarreling with Pork, Rosa and Tina bickering, her own acrimonious arguments with Sue Ellen, Gerald's bawling threats. No wonder Charles had been a sissy, coming from a home like this. Here, excitement never entered in, voices were never raised. Everyone deferred gently to the opinions of others, and, in the end, the black, grizzled autocrat in the kitchen had his way. Scarlett, who had hoped for a freer rein when she escaped Mammy's supervision, discovered to her sorrow that Uncle Peter's standards of ladylike conduct, especially for Miss Charles's widow,
were even stricter than Mammy's. In such a household, Scarlet came back to herself, and almost before she realized it, her spirits rose to normal. She was only 17. She had superb health and energy, and Charles's people did their best to make her happy. If they fell a little short of this, it was not their fault, for no one could take out of her heart the ache that throbbed whenever Ashley's name was mentioned. And Melanie mentioned it so often. But Melanie and Pity were tireless in planning ways to soothe the sorrow under which they thought she labored. They put their own grief into the background in order to divert her. They fussed about her food and her hours for taking afternoon naps and for taking carriage rides. They not only admired her extravagantly, her high-spiritedness, her figure, her tiny hands and feet, her white skin, but they said so frequently, petting, hugging and kissing her to emphasize their loving words. Scarlet did not care for the caresses, but she basked in the compliments. No one at Terra had ever said so many charming things about her. In fact, Mammy had spent her time deflating her conceit. Little Wade was no longer an annoyance, for the family, black and white, and the neighbors idolized him, and there was a never-ceasing rivalry as to whose lap he should occupy. Melanie, especially, doted on him. Even in his worst screaming spells, Melanie thought him adorable and said so, adding, "Oh, you precious darling, I just wish you were mine." Sometimes Scarlet found it hard to dissemble her feelings, for she still thought Aunt Pity the silliest of old ladies, and her vagueness and vaporings irritated her unendurably. She disliked Melanie with a jealous dislike that grew as the days went by. And sometimes she had to leave the room abruptly when Melanie, beaming with loving pride, spoke of Ashley or read his letters aloud. But all in all, life went on as happily as was possible under the circumstances. Atlanta was more interesting than Savannah or Charleston or Tara, and it offered so many strange wartime occupations that she had little time to think or mope. But sometimes, when she blew out the candle and burrowed her head into the pillow, she sighed and thought, "If only Ashley wasn't married. If only I didn't have to nurse in that plagued hospital. Oh, if only I could have some beaux." She had immediately loathed nursing, but she could not escape this duty because she was on both Mrs. Meade's and Mrs. Merriweather's committees. That meant 4 mornings a week in the sweltering, stinking hospital, with her hair tied up in a towel and a hot apron covering her from neck to feet. Every matron, old or young, in Atlanta, nursed, and did it with an enthusiasm that seemed to Scarlet little short of fanatic. They took it for granted that she was imbued with their own patriotic fervor, and would have been shocked to know how slight an interest in the war she had. Except for the ever-present torment that Ashley might be killed, the war interested her not at all. And nursing was something she did simply because she didn't know how to get out of it. Certainly there was nothing romantic about nursing. To her, it meant groans, delirium, death, and smells. The hospitals were filled with dirty, bewhiskered, verminous men who smelled terribly and bore on their bodies wounds hideous enough to turn a Christian's stomach. The hospital stank of gangrene, the odor assaulting her nostrils long before the doors were reached. A sickish, sweet smell that clung to her hands and hair and haunted her in her dreams. Flies and mosquitoes and gnats hovered in droning, singing swarms over the wards, tormenting the men to curses and weak sobs. And Scarlet, scratching her own mosquito bites, swung palmetto fans until her shoulders ached, and she wished that all the men were dead. Melanie, however,
did not seem to mind the smells, the wounds, or the nakedness, which Scarlet thought strange in one who was the most timorous and modest of women. Sometimes, when holding basins and instruments while Dr. Mead cut out gangrened flesh, Melanie looked very white. And once, after such an operation, Scarlet found her in the linen closet vomiting quietly into a towel. But as long as she was where the wounded could see her, she was gentle, sympathetic and cheerful, and the men in the hospitals called her an angel of mercy. Scarlet would have liked that title, too. But it involved touching men crawling with lice, running fingers down throats of unconscious patients to see if they were choking on swallowed tobacco quids, bandaging stumps, and picking maggots out of festering flesh. No, she did not like nursing. Perhaps it might have been endurable if she had been permitted to use her charms on the convalescent men, for many of them were attractive and well-born. But this she could not do in her widowed state. The young ladies of the town, who were not permitted to nurse for fear they would see sights unfit for virgin eyes, had the convalescent wards in their charge. Unhampered by matrimony or widowhood, they made vast inroads on the convalescents. And even the least attractive girls, Scarlet observed gloomily, had no difficulty in getting engaged. With the exception of desperately ill and severely wounded men, Scarlet's was a completely feminized world, and this irked her, for she neither liked nor trusted her own sex, and worse still, was always bored by it. But on 3 afternoons a week, she had to attend sewing circles and bandage-rolling committees of Melanie's friends. The girls who had all known Charles were very kind and attentive to her at these gatherings, especially Fanny Elsing and Maybelle Merriweather, the daughters of the town dowagers. But they treated her deferentially, as if she were old and finished, and their constant chatter of dances and beaux made her both envious of their pleasures and resentful that her widowhood barred her from such activities. While she was 3 times as attractive as Fanny and Maybelle, oh, how unfair life was! How unfair that everyone should think her heart was in the grave when it wasn't at all. It was in Virginia, with Ashley. But in spite of these discomforts, Atlanta pleased her very well. And her visit lengthened as the weeks slipped by. Chapter 9. Scarlet sat in the window of her bedroom that midsummer morning, and disconsolately watched the wagons and carriages full of girls, soldiers, and chaperones ride gaily out Peachtree Road in search of woodland decorations for the bazaar, which was to be held that evening for the benefit of the hospitals. The red road lay checkered in shade and sun glare beneath the overarching trees, and the many hooves kicked up little red clouds of dust. One wagon, ahead of the others, bore 4 stout negroes with axes to cut evergreens and drag down the vines. And the back of this wagon was piled high with napkin-covered hampers, split oak baskets of lunch, and 12 watermelons. 2 of the black bucks were equipped with banjo and harmonica, and they were rendering a spirited version of "If You Want to Have a Good Time, Join the Cavalry." Behind them streamed the merry cavalcade, girls cool in flowered cotton dresses, with light shawls, bonnets, and mitts to protect their skins, and little parasols held over their heads. Elderly ladies placid and smiling amid the laughter, and carriage-to-carriage calls and jokes. Convalescents from the hospitals wedged in between stout chaperones and slender girls, who made great fuss and to-do over them. Officers on horseback idling at snail's pace beside the carriages. Wheels creaking, spurs jingling, gold braid gleaming, parasols bobbing, fans swishing, Negroes singing. Everybody was riding out Peachtree Road to gather greenery and have a picnic and melon cutting. Everybody, thought Scarlet morosely, except me. They all waved and called to her as they went by, and she tried to respond with a good grace, but it was difficult. A hard little pain had started in her heart, and was travelling slowly up toward her throat, where it would become a lump, and the lump would soon become tears. Everybody was going to the picnic, except her. And everybody was going to the bazaar and the ball tonight, except her. That is, everybody except her and Pitypat and Melly and the other unfortunates in town who were in mourning. But Melly and Pitypat did not seem to mind. It had not even occurred to them to want to go. It had occurred to Scarlet, and she did want to go, tremendously. It simply wasn't fair. She had worked twice as hard as any girl in town getting things ready for the bazaar. She had knitted socks and baby caps and afghans and mufflers and tatted yards of lace and painted china hair receivers and mustache cups. And she had embroidered half a dozen sofa pillowcases with a Confederate flag on them. The stars were a bit lopsided, to be sure, some of them almost being round and others having 6 or even 7 points, but the effect was good. Yesterday she had worked until she was worn out in the dusty old barn of an armory, draping yellow and pink and green cheesecloth on the booths that lined the walls. Under the supervision of the ladies' hospital committee, this was plain hard work and no fun at all. It was never fun to be around Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Elsing and Mrs. Whiting and have them boss you like you were one of their darkies, and have to listen to them brag about how popular their daughters were. And worst of all, she had burned 2 blisters on her fingers helping Pitypat and Cookie make layer cakes for raffling. And now, having worked like a field hand, she had to retire decorously when the fun was just beginning. Oh, it wasn't fair that she should have a dead husband and a baby yelling in the next room and be out of everything that was pleasant. Just a little over a year ago, she was dancing and wearing bright clothes instead of this dark mourning, and was practically engaged to 3 boys. She was only 17 now, and there was still a lot of dancing left in her feet. Oh, it wasn't fair! Life was going past her, down a hot, shady summer road. Life with gray uniforms and jingling spurs and flowered organdy dresses and banjos playing. She tried not to smile and waved too enthusiastically to the men she knew best, the ones she'd nursed in the hospital. But it was hard to subdue her dimples, hard to look as though her heart were in the grave, when it wasn't. Her bowing and waving were abruptly halted when Pitypat entered the room, panting as usual from climbing the stairs, and jerked her away from the window unceremoniously. "Have you lost your mind, honey? Waving at men out of your bedroom window? I declare, Scarlet, I'm shocked. What would your mother say?"
"Well, they didn't know it was my bedroom."
"But they suspect it was your bedroom, and that's just as bad. Honey, you mustn't do things like that. Everybody will be talking about you and saying you are fast. And anyway, Mrs. Merriweather knew it was your bedroom." "And I suppose she'll tell all the boys, the old cat."
"Honey, hush.
Dolly Merriweather's my best friend."
"Well, she's a cat just the same."
"Oh, I'm sorry. Auntie, don't cry. I forgot it was my bedroom window. I won't do it again. I just wanted to see them go by. I wish I was going. Honey."
"Well, I do. I'm so tired of sitting at home."
"Scarlet, promise me that you won't say things like that."
"People would talk so."
They'd say you didn't have proper respect for poor Charlie.
Oh, Auntie, don't cry.
Oh, now I've made you cry, too,
sobbed Pitypat, in a pleased way, fumbling in her skirt pocket for her handkerchief. The hard little pain had at last reached Scarlet's throat, and she wailed out loud. Not, as Pitypat thought, for poor Charlie, but because the last sound of the wheels and the laughter were dying away. Melanie rustled in from her room, a worried frown puckering her forehead, a brush in her hands, her usually tidy black hair, freed of its net, fluffing about her face in a mass of tiny curls and waves.
"Darlings, what's the matter?"
"Charlie," sobbed Pitypat, surrendering utterly to the pleasure of her grief and burying her head on Melly's shoulder.
"Oh,"
said Melly, her lip quivering at the mention of her brother's name.
"Be brave, dear. Don't cry. Oh, Scarlet."
Scarlet had thrown herself on the bed and was sobbing at the top of her voice, sobbing for her lost youth and the pleasures of youth that were denied her, sobbing with the indignation and despair of a child who once could get anything she wanted by sobbing, and now knows that sobbing can no longer help her. She burrowed her head in the pillow and cried and kicked with her feet at the tufted counterpane.
"I might as well be dead," she sobbed passionately.
Before such an exhibition of grief, Pitypat's easy tears ceased, and Melly flew to the bedside to comfort her sister-in-law.
"Dear, don't cry. Try to think how much Charlie loved you, and let that comfort you. Try to think of your darling baby."
Indignation at being misunderstood mingled with Scarlet's forlorn feeling of being out of everything and strangled all utterance. That was fortunate, for if she could have spoken, she would have cried out truths couched in Gerald's forthright words. Melanie patted her shoulder, and Pitypat tiptoed heavily about the room, pulling down the shades.
"Don't do that,"
shouted Scarlet, raising a red and swollen face from the pillow.
"I'm not dead enough for you to pull down the shades, though I might as well be. Oh, do go away and leave me alone."
She sank her face into the pillow again, and after a whispered conference, the two standing over her tiptoed out. She heard Melanie say to Pitypat, in a low voice as they went down the stairs, "Aunt Pity, I wish you wouldn't speak of Charles to her. You know how it always affects her. Poor thing, she gets that queer look. And I know she's trying not to cry. We mustn't make it harder for her." Scarlet kicked the coverlet in impotent rage, trying to think of something bad enough to say.
"God's nightgown!"
she cried at last, and felt somewhat relieved. How could Melanie be content to stay at home and never have any fun and wear crepe for her brother when she was only 18 years old? Melanie did not seem to know or care that life was riding by with jingling spurs. "But she's such a stick," thought Scarlet, pounding the pillow. "And she never was popular like me, so she doesn't miss the things I miss. And besides, she's got Ashley, and I haven't got anybody." And at this fresh woe, she broke into renewed outcries. She remained gloomily in her room until afternoon. And then the sight of the returning picnickers, with wagons piled high with pine boughs, vines and ferns, did not cheer her. Everyone looked happily tired as they waved to her again, and she returned their greetings drearily. Life was a hopeless affair, and certainly not worth living. Deliverance came in the form she least expected when, during the after-dinner nap period,
Mrs. Merriweather and Mrs. Elsing drove up. Startled at having callers at such an hour, Melanie, Scarlet, and Aunt Pittypat roused themselves, hastily hooked their basques, smoothed their hair, and descended to the parlor.
"Mrs. Bunnell's children have the measles," said Mrs. Merriweather abruptly, showing plainly that she held Mrs. Bunnell personally responsible for permitting such a thing to happen.
"And the McClure girls have been called to Virginia," said Mrs. Elsing in her die-away voice, fanning herself languidly, as if neither this nor anything else mattered very much. "Dallas McClure is wounded."
"How dreadful!" chorused their hostesses. "Is poor Dallas—"
"No, just through the shoulder," said Mrs. Merriweather briskly. "But it couldn't possibly have happened at a worse time. The girls are going north to bring him home. But skies above, we haven't time to sit here talking. We must hurry back to the armory and get the decorating done. Pity, we need you and Melly tonight to take Mrs. Bunnell's and the McClure girls' places."
"Oh, but Dolly, we can't go."
"Don't say can't to me, Pittypat Hamilton," said Mrs. Merriweather vigorously. "We need you to watch the dockies with refreshments. That was what Mrs. Bunnell was to do. And, Melly, you must take the McClure girls' booth."
"Oh, we just couldn't, with poor Charlie dead only a—" "I know how you feel, but there isn't any sacrifice too great for the cause," broke in Mrs. Elsing in a soft voice that settled matters.
"Oh, we'd love to help, but why can't you get some sweet, pretty girls to take the booths?"
Mrs. Merriweather snorted a trumpeting snort.
"I don't know what's come over the young people these days. They have no sense of responsibility. All the girls who haven't already taken booths have more excuses than you could shake a stick at. Oh, they don't fool me. They just don't want to be hampered in making up to the officers, that's all. And they're afraid their new dresses won't show off behind booth counters. I wish to goodness that blockade runner